first, only gays and IV drug users were being killed by AIDS. But now we know every one of us could be devastated by it. The fact is, over 50,000 men, women, and children now carry the AIDS virus. That in 3 years, nearly 2,000 of us will be dead. But AIDS can be stopped, and you can help stop it. If you have sex, have just one safe partner, or always use condoms. Always.
Yes, you may well remember that, the Grim Reaper ad from 1987. It was very controversial and really horrifying at the time, the dark figure bowling people over. Not, though, as horrifying as the reality. In Australia, Sydney's gay community was hit first. If you were diagnosed, you would more than likely be dead within 16 months. 2 decades on, it's a very different picture. For many, HIV/AIDS is not the death sentence it once was, and for the first time in 10 years or so, numbers of HIV infections have plateaued, which means it's timely to look at the past, present and future of HIV/AIDS in Australia. And to do this, I'm joined by Bill Botell, these days director of the HIV/AIDS project at the Lowy Institute, but in the 1980s, the architect of the Australian response to the disease and senior advisor to the health minister of the time, Neil Blewett. Also with me is Ross Duffin, a gay man who's been involved in the community response to HIV/AIDS for over 20 years. And a little later, you'll hear from James Wilson, who's on the board of Positive Life New South Wales. Bill, I want to start with you. If we go back to the beginning, 82, I think, was the first infection. What did people know about this mysterious illness?
Well, the great problem was that nobody knew anything. In 1982, seemingly out of nowhere, at the time, came a genuine mystery ailment that seemed to strike gay men in Sydney, but was manifest around the world. Amongst many different populations. At that time, nobody knew whether what the infective agent was. It only became apparent in subsequent years after a tremendous amount of scientific resources were tossed at the problem that it was a virus. So this thing emerged very gradually. And, of course, the fear and the, not to say the panic at that time in 82, 83, was quite considerable because every day we were confronted with more and more people becoming ill and more people dying.
At the time, you were calling for calm. The government was calling for calm. But you must also have been really worried about why so many people were getting sick.
Oh, yes. Well, this was a terrible problem. And it was really shocking that so many young people, young men, were becoming infected and dying. And at that time, nobody knew where it would stop. There were all sorts of predictions and prognostications about what was happening, where this problem would end. So there was very little fact and information, real information to go on at that time. However, it did start to resolve itself quite quickly. I mean, it didn't last for decades, this problem.
No, it
became apparent very quickly, relatively, that it was a virus, that it was not so easy to transmit, and that there were very effective and good measures that could be taken to inhibit transmission.
Ross, you must remember this extremely well. How do you remember feeling at the time?
Well, I guess my early memories is in 1981 when the first news story about HIV was printed in the Australian paper. I was actually speaking on radio and someone gave to me this story about a gay cancer and I said, cancers can't be gay. And then in 1982, I was actually travelling in United States for quite a period. The doctors in San Francisco had got together to hold a meeting about what was going on. And we were starting to acknowledge that what was going on was real and it was disproportionately affecting gay men. And I actually did an interview for one of the doctors for radio. And he said that they'd just learnt that there was probably an infectious agent involved. And they'd learnt that by looking at the contact patterns of men in Orange County. And I remember the most popular song at the time was called It's the End of the World as We Know It, and that was what reverberated in my head. That it was this.
So were you scared?
I knew that it would fundamentally change our lives, that if there was an agent that was probably spread sexually, we didn't know at the time, that the ways that we constructed our lives of gay men were fundamentally going to change.
So 3 or 4 years on, the infection had got a real grip. And there were obituaries in the gay papers almost every week at that stage. I imagine that would have a real effect on the community, on you.
The obituaries really didn't take off till about 1990. Like, if you look at when people have died in the history of the epidemic, and there are thousands who have died over the course of almost 30 years now, that the majority of the deaths occurred in the years between 1990 to 1996. Mm-hmm. In fact, over 60% of them did. So there weren't a lot of deaths in the 80s, but they certainly were coming. So in the 80s, those deaths of known figures were very well published and funerals were very large. In the 90s, when there were so many, and when you would open up the pages of the Sydney Star Observer every week and there'd be 10 to 12 people in Sydney, funerals just got overwhelming, and so it became...
Could put you off opening the paper.
It did.
I can imagine.
Yeah, you used to try and skip over those pages.
Because you tested positive in 87?
Yes.
Did you think that was really your lot?
I thought, you know, when we knew how HIV was spread and where it was spread, I thought that I would probably be positive through having travelled through the United States in 1982. The HIV antibody test actually didn't become available for some years later.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, AIDS organisations, of which I was associated with, were recommending against gay men to be tested because there were no treatments and there was a lot of stigma and discrimination. But despite that, there was a very powerful desire to know.
Yes.
And so I, despite the recommendation of the organisation I was working for, went and got tested. But in the period where I got tested, the government at the time had introduced notification laws, and I didn't actually go back and get my result in sort of silent protest about notification laws. And I actually didn't go back until 1987 when I found out that I was positive. But the reason why I went back was that early treatments were starting to become available.
Right.
So AZT was being talked about by 1987. And there was, from not having a reason to find out your antibody status, it suddenly became quite a potent reason to know.
Bill, you witnessed an interesting phenomenon where communities who wouldn't normally talk to each other actually started talking to one another. How did that happen?
Well, when it came time to decide how the federal government particularly and all the other governments of Australia should respond, we had to make a fundamental decision about who was going to create policy and what policy was going to be funded. Were we going to have a punitive response, as was occurred elsewhere in the world, particularly United States,
yes,
or one based on prevention? We opted for a preventive response, but to do that we had to reach out to the communities most affected, and in Australia, or most at risk, they were gay men, injecting drug users, sex workers. Of course, there were people with haemophilia who were infected by being recipients of transfusions and so on. So the threshold decision, if you like, that we had to take was to get all of those people around a table, actually, not just metaphorically, and say...
Was that difficult?
It was extremely difficult. It was resisted trenchantly by the health bureaucrats and others at the time, and by a very small band of politicians who didn't think that the affected communities had a role to play in setting and implementing policy. And I'm very happy to say that Dr. Blewett and the federal government at the time, and supported by many leading figures in the opposition, opted for a totally radically different alternative, which was to put our trust and faith in the people who are closest to the problem, to not just consult and then ignore what they said, but to actually do what these groups said, and then to back sensible policy with the money and the resources.
It's almost unprecedented, isn't it, for a government to say, we are really going to consult, and then to really do it, and then to back it up.
Yes, well, I think there's people love talking about consultation, but of course it's always, often is lip service. Mm. People want to have that as a fig leaf, but in fact, we not only consulted, we put the affected groups, and of course supported by the researchers and the clinicians who are close to the problem, right at the heart of the policy response. And we got some very radical and bold policies at that time, needle and syringe exchanges, talking about condoms, addressing all of the problems related to sex and drugs, particularly with young people. But in fact, those policies, once they were implemented, weren't so radical and bold. They were common sense, they were practical, and over 25 years, they worked.
On Life Matters today, we are talking really about the past, present and future of HIV/AIDS in Australia. And we're doing this as the number of infections has plateaued, first time in 10 years. My guests are Bill Botell, director of the HIV/AIDS project at the Lowy Institute and absolutely at the centre of policy making in the 1980s with the federal government. Ross Duffin, who's a gay man who's been involved in the community's response to HIV/AIDS for more than 20 years. And a little later we'll hear from James Wilson, who's on the board of Positive Living in New South Wales. Ross, you were the first education officer for the AIDS Council of New South Wales. What were your observations? What were your observations of this dialogue between the government and the gay community?
I think some really remarkable things happened in the early years. So a group of sex workers organised to form sex worker organisations, a group of people who had been or were still injecting drug users organised giving out needles to people. And gay men, after some resistance, there was some fantastic work done by gay journalists in particular to alert people to what was coming. And so in a way, the communities responded without funding, you know, and had an interest in their own health. I think the amazing thing the government did was, apart from policy action to protect the blood bank, which was, you know, we were the first government to do that as soon as it was technologically possible, it was I think the amazing document was the first national strategy response, where the government got a whole set of people together to talk in very ways. And in terms of what it was like in those early days, there was a real hunger for information. That while you can perhaps describe one story as which we've already talked about, as coping with all of the grief and loss, there was also a sense of people coming together to overcome a problem that was actually, people actually got a lot of meaning from. And, you know, in an epidemic, there was also a lot of joy and a lot of black humour and a lot of horror, but it wasn't all, you know, a bad story, if you like.
Essentially, Bill, Australia has, on the whole, a good story. The process and the direction the government decided to take, and I know you were key in that decision making, which was all about harm minimisation, which was all about what you have called a social vaccine approach to HIV, has worked. Essentially, we showed the world how to do it, and the world hasn't done it. Now, why is that?
Yes, that's an excellent question. I must say, when I finished my first period in relation to HIV/AIDS policy, and it was very clear that the bottom-up approach, if you like, the communities working together and politicians approaching it in a serious and common-sense way, collectively we had done a very big thing, and tens of thousands of young Australians consequently were not affected or affected as badly or dying or dead from HIV infection, and the rates were going in the right way. So when I left this the first time around, I thought, well, there it is. It's completely obvious what works. It's completely obvious, more importantly, what doesn't work. Sanction and isolation and hysteria and quarantine and all the things that were being done elsewhere in the world. Therefore, people will adopt the sane and sensible policies that we had here. And they didn't. There was the period of the 1990s internationally was an absolute disgrace. There was weak and insipid leadership at the very top, the World Health Organization and other agencies. There was a mendacious campaign conducted, particularly in the United States of America, where this was supposed to be a divine punishment for sin or all of this other stuff. And, of course, that was a ridiculous basis for creating public health policy. And there was no money. People didn't, the big donors and others, did not put money behind proper preventive strategies. Consequently, the thing in the 1990s globally became an absolute catastrophe. 25 million people have died because of HIV infection. And they have died not by some tsunami or a meteorite hitting Earth. They've died because people who knew better, who should have known better, who were in positions of authority in many countries of the world, opted deliberately for policies that would spread the disease, that would make it more and more simple for people to acquire it and then do nothing much to look after them when they got it. Now, I'm happy to say that early in the 2000s, the weakness of this approach, the real disaster that had been created, common sense started to prevail at the top levels, and the international community started to rally behind the sorts of policies and approaches that we had adopted in Australia 10 and 15 years before.
On Life Matters today, we are talking about HIV/AIDS in this country. Also, as you just heard, Bill Botell, who's from the Lowy Institute, talk there about what happened in the rest of the world when it didn't follow Australian leadership. My guests, my other guests, are Ross Duffin, who's a gay man who's been involved in the community's response to HIV for decades, and James Wilson, who we are about to hear from. If you're a relative of James, we're just about to get to him, so stay with us. Ross, I just want to touch briefly on the mid-1990s, the development of combination therapy. How did that change people's lives, how people felt as well?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I guess one of the other great stories in HIV is the partnership between medicine and people with HIV and the development of effective treatments. And I guess the other really big policy response in Australia was changes to the drug regulation system to prioritise drugs for life-threatening conditions, so that the system was changed, so the priority was given for systems of early access to drugs for people with life-threatening conditions, which continues to be an ongoing problem. I mean, we see stories in politics and the media all the time about problems of accessing potentially expensive, useful therapies. You know, when there was an international conference in Vancouver where it was announced that combination therapies worked and there was headlines across the newspapers, but it didn't mean that we suddenly went and had a party and declared it was over. And I think it's quite important to say that to talk in a modern sense about what treatments mean and what they don't mean. So when treatments arrived, we didn't know how long they were going to work and we were concerned about side effects. And certainly the experiences in the early years of treatments is that they, as we got to learn how to use them best, is that there were some problems with side effects. But years on down the track, we actually know that they work. So, for example, I've been on combination treatments for over 14 years. I know people who, you know, friends who you would have looked at and said they're in their last months of life, who were able to access treatments and are now doing quite well.
I do want to bring in James, who's been extremely patient. James Wilson is on the board of Positive New South Wales, formerly People Living with HIV/AIDS. When you hear those stories, some of the things that Ross has been talking about, but I'm sure you've heard them many times, of what it was like in the 1980s, what do you think? Can you relate to it at all?
I don't think I can ever fully relate to it. I wasn't there, and I've never lived through anything that sounds as ghastly as how it's portrayed to me by friends and colleagues that were around in the 80s when the HIV virus originally hit our shores, so to speak.
I remember a gay friend telling me, it must have been 9 or 10 years ago, that the young guys in Sydney just weren't scared and they weren't using condoms anymore. And he was kind of shaking his head in wonder at this.
I think the majority probably do, but I think there's a growing sentiment within the younger gay community within Sydney that that HIV is now a, you know, manageable illness, which is what we're being told anyway. And so they go, well, it's a manageable illness, so why do we need to worry? Why do we need to wear condoms anymore? I think it's a bit of a lose-lose situation, because you're telling people that it's a manageable illness in order to, so that there won't be this hysteria and panic around it anymore. But at the same time, it's leading to a rise in infections.
You say you got some, well, lightweight, from the sounds of things, education on STIs at school. Do you think there needs to be another campaign about safe sex that's more direct?
Well, the current safe sex campaign that's out at the moment, I'm not sure if you've seen it on the streets. I think it's on buses and billboards. It's just a general STI message.
This is about sleeping with one person means that you've slept with all these other people. That's the one I've seen on television.
That one isn't actually that bad, but there's some poster ones which are, it just has a picture of someone's face and a back of another person has some generic message. I can't even remember what it says, but I mean, that campaign is useless, essentially. It doesn't say anything. It doesn't do anything. There's no shock value. There's no humour. Nothing.
So how can we reach, especially young people? Media is so much more diverse now. Not everybody even within the various communities, read the local gay paper. What would you like to see?
Well, personally, what I'd like to see is more viral marketing campaigns, using the internet better. In terms of ad campaigns, I think there's been a tendency over the past couple of years not to use the shock and awe tactics like the Grim Reaper campaign in the 80s, because the viewpoint now is that if you use such a campaign, then it will put those who are HIV positive offside with the rest of the community.
Now, Ross, earlier you were alluding to older men who may have been on combination therapy for 15 or more years causing other health problems. What is being observed in the community?
Can I just say something about what James said in relation to young people and infection? I mean, I think the evidence is that gay men for 30 years have persistently used condoms, you know, a remarkable percentage, despite the fact that when you talk to them, they don't like them.
Nobody likes using condoms.
And that persistence is actually quite remarkable. Mm. And I think you can't expect to start to have 10 to 15 years where we've said treatments work, get on them, and where people know that their friends are doing well. You can't expect that to influence the way people think about what HIV infection might mean to them, which is why I think we actually have to talk about a modern story of what HIV means to people, to balance that treatments work and you do all fantastically well. Now, that's a really good story, and it's really important that people find out that they're positive and go on treatments when it's appropriate for them. So that's one story. But another story is that the way in which the epidemic is changing. And so, for example, in 1996, when treatments arrived, there were only about 1,500 Australians over 50 who had HIV infection. Now, at the current moment, there are about 5,000 Australians with HIV who are over 50. And in the future, about 50% of the epidemic will be people who are over 50. And now that's simply a consequence of keeping people alive because treatments work. But we also now know which we didn't know before, is what treatments mean in the longer term. So there's this now a condition called premature ageing. And basically, because of HIV treatments, because of HIV itself, because of modifiable lifestyle risk factors and because of ageing, people with HIV infection are far more likely to have the typical morbidities we associate with ageing. So for an average 55-year-old with HIV who's been on treatments for 15 years, they're likely to be being also treated for 3 or 4 other conditions. That's the same as a 75-year-old who doesn't have HIV.
There's a sort of 20-year burden.
Well, the life expectancy is not 20 years less, but the morbidities that you typically associate with ageing are much more common and often more severe much earlier. And so that really HIV still, despite treatments, HIV still remains a serious condition, and that people need to factor in that reality as well as treatments work when they're thinking about what HIV means to them.
Bill Botell, if I could come back to you. In 2009, we've recently seen a slight decrease in the number of infections. I think I'm right in that. It's not what you'd call a trend. What is the rough makeup now of people living with HIV/AIDS in Australia?
About 5 or 6 years ago, we did get down to the historically low level of about 700 new infections a year. And then over the last several years, partly for the reasons James says, partly because some state governments took their eye off the ball, they didn't do the campaigns and the consistent, sustained messaging that was necessary to influence young people, this rate of new infections rose to about 1,000 new infections. Now, the problem when infections start to rise gradually is that it has a knock-on effect, so that a person who becomes HIV positive now, the danger of it is that there'll be a multiplication effect. So it's very difficult to bring that level down quickly. But sustained and effective pressure, particularly information directed at young people, will tend to bring that down. So what we've seen in the last year is a bit of a levelling off, thankfully, as the governments have stepped up to the plate. They realise that more needs to be done. There's been quite a reinvigoration at the federal level. And I know at the various AIDS council levels and so on, there's been a lot more concentration on what to do and how to do it. So I hope that we hit this plateau, and this is a genuine plateau, that we don't get more infections, And then over time, we reduce the number of new infections back to something like the level that we had obtained 3 or 4 years ago. The paradox of prevention, of course, is the more effective and better you are at preventing the problem at all, then the less people see
yes.
there is a problem to be aware of. And this is just a paradox of the human condition. So it is difficult. We've got to spend a lot of money and time and effort to keep a problem from not becoming apparent.
Indeed.
And this is difficult in tough economic times, of course.
Well, gentlemen, that is where we'll leave it. Bill Botell, director of the Lowy Institute's HIV-AIDS project, Ross Duffin, gay man who's been involved in the community responses to HIV-AIDS for over 20 years, and James Wilson on the board of Positive Life New South Wales. This is Life Matters with me, Richard Adie, and you're on ABC Radio National.